Welcome back to Main Street on this Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this segment is called Philosophical Currents. Of course, President Trump's State of the Union address last night got me thinking that in times of political tension and global instability, we often hear appeals to national unity or defending the nation. But what exactly is a nation? Is it a piece of land defined by borders? Is it a shared language or culture? Is it a constitution? Or is it something less tangible, a shared story, maybe a collective identity, even a moral commitment? Today, we explore the deceptively simple question, what makes a nation? And joining us, as always, is University of North Dakota philosophy professor, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. Jack is, of course, the host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life that can be heard every second Sunday here on Prairie Public at 5 p.m. Jack, welcome back to Philosophical Currents.
I am happy to be here, and the deceptively simple questions are almost always the most interesting, because this question, what makes a nation and what unifies a nation, is a fault line that runs pretty much through the history of political thought.
So what are we talking about, Jack? I mean, is a nation the same thing as a state or a country?
The idea of a nation state is actually fairly new. It was established right around the time of World War I, which is really the war that ends the old order, ends the empire, ends the multinational way of looking at the world. But this idea of a nation state evolved over thousands of years from these little villages and towns to tribes to the Greek world. What we think of Greece, they thought of as separate, almost nations like Sparta and Syracuse and Athens and things like that. So there's always been this negotiation of what a nation is, and there's always been this tension between the geographical boundaries and the ethnic or religious or historical boundaries. And that also leads to all sorts of trouble, because after World War I, they, for example, carved up the Middle East into all of these nations that didn't respect ethnic and historical boundaries. And so now to be an Iraqi doesn't really mean very much, whereas now to be a member of a particular historical lineage is divided up between nations. So on the one hand, this feels like a natural understanding of the world. On the other hand, what a nation is goes a very long way towards deciding both how stable and how calm the world we live in is.
So our nation is coming up on its 250th anniversary, right? Our nation. So what makes our nation? Jack, is it our shared culture? Is it our language? Is it the shared ethnicity that we experience here in the United States? Shared political principles we have? Is there one thing that matters more in this history, great history of our country?
So the thing that made the United States unique, and really still does, is that citizenship is a purely political distinction. And historically, a person who was naturalized the moment they became a citizen was as much of a citizen as someone whose family came through the Mayflower. And so the idea of being an American was abstract and disconnected from history. This means that we are a very pluralistic people, and that our neighbors may be different than us in a variety of ways. But also, we are a fairly large nation with a lot of diverse histories and complexities. So California and Texas and New York and North Dakota are in many ways nations unto themselves. This is one of the things that people outside the United States don't really get. So what is it that America is? And the answer largely is America is the story we tell. America is the lineage that we hold on to and that we pass on to our kids and that we represent in our symbols like our flags and our statues. But here's the problem. Every story is only as good or meaningful as its interpretation. So you can tell the story of America as the progress of individual rights. You can tell the story of America as the growth of the federal government. You can tell the story of America as conflict between states with, you know, a really problematic period in the middle, right? Because America, and frankly, any nation, is the narrative that people use to identify it, it's going to be very malleable to the politics and to the circumstances that people are concerned about at any given time.
Jack, I want you to talk about pluralism versus unity, if you would. In a diverse society like the United States, is national unity about sameness, or is it about agreeing to live with deep differences? And how do you account for both of those ideas in a nation?
The first concern of any nation is stability. How does it stay itself without falling apart? And how does it protect itself from the invasion of others? And so you have this question, which is, what makes a society stable when there are people with radically different opinions? And there are two ways of answering this question, basically. And I actually have an entire class on this, Philosophy 355, Social and Political Philosophy. And it asks the question, do we manage diversity by looking at what everyone has in common? We're all human beings. We all have these essential rights. We all have this overlapping similarity. Or do we manage diversity by focusing on how people are different and trying to create conflict that isn't destructive and trying to create interactive ways of learning about and coordinating with others? And this has been a tremendous debate in the late 20th century and now, which is, you know, to what extent do we consider ourselves human beings, and to what extent do we consider ourselves people with individual histories? And so it also is going to depend on how much we value that diversity. Do we think difference is a detriment and we want to create a more integrated, assimilated society? Is the fact that Fred and Juan and Muhammad are fundamentally different, is that a compromise and a weakness and something we want to mitigate? Or is the fact that they're different in important ways a strength and something we want to cultivate and celebrate? And so that question of how we feel about difference is going to go a long way to determine how we manage that difference, because we're asking, are we hiding it or are we showing it off? Are we tamping it down or are we cultivating it? And that varies from administration to administration and, frankly, from generation to generation. Different generations have dealt with the question of conformity in very different ways. And starting from the 1960s, really on, the diversity also manifested itself between generations, right? Mm-hmm. Parents and kids of the 1960s had much more difficulty talking to each other than parents and kids in the 50s and 40s and 30s because of sexual revolution and because of changes in the world. And so the diversity is not just, I would say, horizontal in the fact that, you know, you and your neighbor might be different in important ways, but it's also vertical in the sense that the succeeding generations may be different. And interestingly enough, Thomas Jefferson argued that the fundamental conflict in any society was, in fact, not government versus citizen or state versus state, but rather generational. And he thought that there should be a nonviolent revolution every 27 years, because 27 years was the length of the generation. And any one of us who's a parent understands that our kids are in some way living fundamentally different lives, right? I talk to my students all the time about the fact that I've been with my wife for more than 25 years, the Tinder and Hinge and all these things didn't exist when I was dating. So I have no idea what they're pairing off experiences are like. So I can give them generic relationship advice, but I can't give them a very specific sense of how to live and pursue this kind of family or whatever they're looking for, because the world is just fundamentally different for them than it is for me.
Enjoying my conversation, as I always do, with University of North Dakota philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. This segment is called Philosophical Currents, and we're exploring what we correctly note is a very deceptively simple question: what makes a nation a nation? Another two terms, Jack, that I'd like you to contrast for us: patriotism versus nationalism. Philosophically, what's the difference between those two terms, and when does love of country become something that's more exclusionary?
This is a great question, and it's a really important distinction. And the way I usually explain it is, patriotism is love of one's country, the way that one thinks that something is good. But nationalism is the love of one's country that assumes that your country is better than other countries, right? So, for example, I love my wife, to continue the theme I mentioned earlier. I love my wife. Do I think my wife is a better wife than every other wife in the world? She may be for me, but I'm sure she's not the best wife in the world. And I don't want people to think she's the best wife in the world, because then they become competitors and try to steal her from me, right? So I'm patriotic when it comes to my wife. I love her. I'm loyal to her. I want her to be the best she can be, and I want to be the best for her that I can be. But I'm not nationalistic when it comes to my wife, because I'm not comparing her and saying all other wives should be modeled on her. And so patriotism and nationalism do two things that are really important. The first is they define what it means to make a country better or to support the country. So a patriot who loves their country but doesn't think it's perfect can say, my country is doing something wrong. I want to heal it. I want to change it. I want to motivate it, right? If God forbid my daughter became a heroin addict, I would do everything I could to heal her and make her better. And there are lots of people who look at the country now, and of course, this is significant disagreement about this, but there's a lot of people look at the country now and say, I love my country, it's sick, I want to change it. But nationalism says, if you don't love your country as it is, you're wrong. And then there's a really interesting division of possibilities. One is leave. Right? Go somewhere else, as if that were possible. But the other is, you think it's wrong, therefore you should change. And you should adopt and absorb the values that the country holds, because you're the one who's sick. And this leads to the distinction between democracies and, among other things, fascism. Because what a democracy says is, individuals come first, individuals have rights, and people have the ability to choose what they consider valuable in the world, and they are the most they can be as individuals who participate in politics. But a fascist society says all individuals are subordinated to the needs of the nation, and often the leader. And our job is to disappear into the collective, to think of ourselves as citizens first and exclusively, and the best part of ourselves is that citizen who serves the collective, who serves the government, and who serves the leader. So you can ask the following question, and I don't mean to be particularly partisan about this, but you can ask the following question. Donald Trump wants something for himself. Is my job to convince Donald Trump that he should pay more attention to me and my needs? Or is my job to accept that Donald Trump wants these things and therefore do what he wants for his vision? And that fundamental distinction tells us whether the individual is primary, more important than the country, or whether the country is primary and more important than the individual. But this is also different than, say, President Kennedy's remark that, you know, don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Kennedy wasn't saying subordinate yourself. Kennedy was saying think of yourself as a partner, as a contributor to make us all better and healthier. And without going down the rabbit hole of fascism, that distinction between nation as priority, nation as visual, as nation as vision, nation as a unity, nation as the primary consideration versus individuals within the nation as a primary consideration is one of the essential indicators of what we need to do in order to make our vision of society stronger or weaker.
I want to extend that just a little bit. And it's something that I've thought about when the United States pulled out of the United States Agency for International Development. As Americans, as tenants of this nation, is our moral responsibility to our fellow citizens more than it is to people in other countries? Why or why not?
This also is a very, very hard question, and it rests on what I always describe as the first question of humanity, which is, am I my brother's keeper? This is the first question that in the Western tradition, human beings, Cain asks God, am I my brother's keeper?
And does my brother have to live here?
And there is this question, to what extent are we all human beings? And so there's a cosmopolitan point of view, which says that we're all human beings and we all have some form, if not equal, responsibility towards others. And then there's a more individualistic or relational point of view that says we have more responsibilities towards our neighbor. And people have struggled with this, and certainly, as you and I have talked about in the past, it's natural for me to prioritize my own child over other children. And that's why we spend a lot more resources on each other than we do on international things. But there's another way of asking the question, and that's as follows. Does helping other countries benefit us specifically? Is it smarter and more strategic to assist and stabilize the world, because then we don't create enemies and then we don't exist in chaos? We are all better in an environment where everyone is getting along and everyone has what they need and no one is desperate. Now, that's a hard, hard goal to meet, but we can ask about USAID as a moral question, or we can ask USAID as a practical strategic question. And in political science, we can compare the first one as sort of this cosmopolitan point of view, but there's this term called realism. And the idea behind realism is every nation is defending itself for its own sake, and every nation is in competition with one another, and every nation is in conflict and a threat with one another, and therefore we have to protect ourselves as best as we can. And even if you take that very pessimistic, skeptical point of view about international politics, the question is still, is helping other people more beneficial to the stability and unity of our own society? And history suggests it is, because the only thing worse than a world war is a civil war. And we don't want either of those two things.
Jack, I'm sorry we have to end this discussion a little bit early in my eyes today, but maybe we can revisit it again right around the 4th of July when our country is turning 250 and talk a little bit more. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and is the director of the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life at the University of North Dakota. And he joins us each month for Philosophical Currents, where we explore the ideas shaping our public life. Jack, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the speed rounds are fun too.